Bartram Park developer Tom Dodson wants back some of the land he 20 years ago agreed to preserve for the state, and he's offering some other acreage in its place. How common is this kind of land swap, and is the trade a good deal? We'll talk to the Times Union reporter who broke the story, one of the area's most vocal environmentalists, and a lobbyist and former mayor whose current firm counts Dodson as one of its clients. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bank in for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or listen to the WJCT app. Just ahead, we'll talk to the TU's Steve Patterson, St. John's Riverkeeper Lisa Reinemann, and former Jacksonville Mayor John Delaney. Call in with your thoughts about the possible conservation land swap, 549-2937. Then later on our Going Green segment, we discuss how to make your central air more efficient, among other HVAC trends. Plus, travel blogger Judy Wells takes us to China's Shaanxi province. All of that ahead, but first this hour. Way back at the beginning of the millennium, Bartram Park developer Tom Dodson agreed to preserve around 2,000 acres of land in South Jacksonville's Julington Turbine Peninsula as part of the state's Conservation and Recreation Lands Program. That land makes up what's now known as the Julington Durbin Preserve Park, and it's owned by the state. The parcel is seen by environmentalists as one of the last buffers between surrounding development and sensitive wetlands, but it's also some of the most valuable real estate around. To help make the development palatable for state regulators, it's still in the early proposal stages, Dodson is offering to turn over 403 acres of land 45 minutes north or 25 miles north on Black Hammock Island. It's around the Timaquan Preserve area. He also wants to pay for Julington Park upgrades, like bathrooms, paved parking, a dog park, and canoe and kayak access, a $1.5 million bill that as of late, neither the state nor the city has footed. Former Mayor John Delaney, who was the city's chief executive when the original $17 million deal was struck, then said the 1999 Julington purchase, quote, may well be the most significant environmental land purchase in Jacksonville. Now, Delaney is working for a firm hired by Dodson's development company. Delaney says the Black Hammock land swap helps protect more land around the Timaquan Preserve, gets needed infrastructure improvements for Julington, and gets Dodson his development. But is the deal a good one? Steve Patterson broke the story for the Times Union, and he joins me now. Steve, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Lisa Reinemann is the St. John's Riverkeeper. Thank you, Lisa, for coming in.
Good morning.
And former Mayor John Delaney joins us by phone. Mr. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you.
Steve, let's start with you. How did you first get on this story? It's my understanding that this is not even really a formal proposal yet.
It's not a formal proposal yet. And I got this simply because a tipster had heard this from another person and had concerns with it. Came to the newspaper, wanted to get, I think, exactly the discussion that's going on now.
So, Mayor, let's go back a bit here. You were the city's chief executive when this land was preserved. According to quotes from you at the time, you considered it a pretty monumental deal. Can you first describe the deal, how it was struck, and then tell us whether you believe this land swap would enhance conservation land in Jacksonville?
Well, first I want to say I'm not employed by the firms I'm going to join yet. That's not until September. I'm not being paid, and I haven't lobbied anybody.
Okay.
If 20 years ago I was presented with a deal to take the Julington Durbin Creek Peninsula, less 400 acres, and also got Black Hammock Island, that's the deal we would have done, because Black Hammock Island's in the middle of in effect, a national park. It's slated and permitted and ready to go for a couple hundred homes, and those are going to be on septic tank. And the idea of an island with septic tanks, this is just not a good combination. And so all I've really said is I think it's a reasonable swap, particularly since there's some – right now, Julington Durbin is not accessible. It's an overgrown trail. You can't even get to it. The city's been charged with maintaining it and hasn't had the resources over the last 20 years to be able to put into it to upgrade it. So it's really about a swap. People that oppose it are saying, "Oh, I want Black Hammock Island as well." Well, that's nice, but that's not the options right now. It's an either or. There's a contract on Black Hammock Island to be sold to a developer, and to me, the swap sounds reasonable.
Okay, and let us know your thoughts. Listeners, give us a call, 549-2937. Again, 549-2937. Lisa, you've expressed some misgivings. You're part of the environmentalists who have been decrying this possibility, the possibility of this deal. You say the development has the potential to be environmentally harmful. What makes this Julington land so sensitive, and what's the ultimate worry here?
Sure, and thank you for this important conversation. In the early 1990s, the state formally downgraded the health of Julington and Durbin Creeks, which were once very pristine, but they downgraded the health of them due to water quality impacts from stormwater, sewage, and other runoffs from the rapid growth in the Mandarin area. Half of the wetlands in this area were destroyed during this time. Luckily, in 1999, not only did Mayor Delaney, but also all 19 council members sponsored the legislation to spend public dollars to protect this land as part of the preservation project. The goal of that project was to manage growth, to protect environmentally sensitive lands, improve water quality, and to provide access to the city's natural areas. And this preserve is doing all of that. In fact, I would argue that if you think these trails are overgrown, you haven't been out there lately. I'll be happy to take anyone out on a guided hike. In fact, we took about 30 folks earlier in May, and it's well maintained. In fact, there's a video at City of Jacksonville by the city's naturalists that they actually take you on a virtual hike, showing you not only the natural wonder, but also this important habitat to many species. It's one of the most biologically diverse areas in this very developed part of the county, and it also protects Julington, Durbin, ultimately the St. John's, and provides flood protection to these areas. And so it's a false choice to think you could have one or the other, because luckily in 2014, we had the voters overwhelmingly approve Amendment 1 to buy conservation lands just like Black Hammock, and we should focus our priorities on protecting both areas.
Mayor Delaney, I'm going to let you respond to that before we go to some of our callers.
Well, it may not sound, and Lisa's a friend, by the way. She worked in my administration when we were doing these things, and I think a lot of her and the Riverkeeper, and I've gotten awards from virtually every environmental group in the state. It may not sound like a false equivalency if you're doing yoga, sitting in a Starbucks, drinking a latte, but the fact of the matter is you can't preserve both. And Lisa didn't really address the development on Black Hammock Island. It's going to release 6 times the nutrients that a development down in Julington, Durbin would release into very pristine waters. And it'd be like in the middle of a national park having a housing development on septic tanks, destroying the view. And so the issue is this swap reasonable? And everybody that's been quoted on this has said both islands or both properties we'd like to preserve. Well, nobody's going forward to buy, no governmental entity has gone forward to buy Black Hammock Island successfully. We tried when I was mayor. I've lusted after that property just about as much as we did the Julington Durbin Creek Peninsula property. All those wetlands will still be there. There'll still be a whole set of uplands. There'll be canoe and kayak access that's really tough to do right now. I don't know if the Riverkeeper or others have cleaned that up since I was out there a couple months ago, but it's... I would call it very undeveloped and very inaccessible, and maybe it's changed in the last 30 or 60 days. But to me, the threat is losing an island in the middle of a national and state park system.
Steve, in your article, you talked about the difference between these two parcels of land and how the Black Hammock Island had a little bit more trouble with people that wanted to develop there. Can you go back on that, what you reported in Sunday's paper?
The last significant effort to develop that property was made in 2006, and that was greeted by lawsuits from three separate lawsuits. Those were resolved that year, but there was simply a lot of opposition, and it's going to be hard case to make to if someone wants to develop that land now. Mr. Dotson, the developer, actually does not own that property, as far as I can tell. He has an option to buy it, and is prepared to buy it to offer as a trade to the state.
Okay, let's get to some of your calls. We have jammed phone lines here. We're going to start with Terry in South Jacksonville. Terry, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say that I actually worked for the St. John's River Water Management District for almost a decade, and one of the properties that I managed was Julington Durbin Preserve. And I just wanted to say that, Mr. Delaney, I'm sorry, but that's incorrect. The property is not inaccessible. It's extremely accessible. We are here right now. There's plenty of parking spots. Anybody can come in, and the community can walk in. It's heavily used. People jog. They walk their dogs. My children and I go once a month and go hiking. And I just was telling them about this issue, and they said, well, I would cry if they put houses on our property. We hike in, and we go to Durbin Creek to catch minnows. So I used to write management plans for the district, and this is one of the properties that we worked on. And this property is legislatively mandated to be preserved in perpetuity for the water and people of the state of Florida. And we managed it with prescribed fire. We brought horses up from Lake George to burn more lands quickly. It has so much development surrounding it that there is only one wind direction that we can burn on, and that's an east wind. And so my colleague that manages the property now, she looks every single day for that east wind that we can burn. Mm-hmm. We've put a lot of time and management efforts in this property by planting longleaf pine, which is a very rare tree in Florida. And
sure.
The diversity level on this property is that of a rainforest. There's so many wildflowers, animals, and threatened gopher tortoise on this property.
Thank you, Terry, for your perspective. We've got a lot of calls to get to. Very quickly, Mayor, I'll let you respond to Terry in South Jacksonville before we get to the next call.
Oh, I'd love to keep it too, but nobody's mentioning Black Hammock Island, which is an island in the middle of a state national park system. That is ripe for it's ready to be developed. It's permitted. The lawsuits have all been resolved, and the pollutants that it's going to put into the water far exceed developing a couple hundred acres on the eastern end of this peninsula. And keep in mind, there's still a massive amount of acreage that's down there, and that's one of the reasons it was an attractive buy. And it's just a question of where you want to swap. You know, I've got a house that I share with five other families up in the mountains, and I would love to be able to stop everybody from building anywhere in my view. And the alternative often is, well, we want to regulate. We want to stop people from being able to do these things. And here I think it's an opportunity to preserve some land in the middle of a national park system, state national park system, and with really a negligible impact on the Julington-Durbin area.
Sure.
I understand that people could say that perhaps Julington-Durbin is more environmentally valuable than Black Hammock Island. I'm not convinced of that. In fact, I think it's going to be a tragedy if Black Hammock Island gets developed with the nutrients and the phosphorus that's going to be dumped in the surrounding waters of the Timofon Preserve.
Sure.
And John, I would have to argue that it would be a tragedy if we lose this protection for Julington and Durbin and the St. John's River in the entire county downstream that's been in place for 20 years. The bulk of the benefit on Black Cab Hammock is going to go to the Nassau Sound and the Nassau River, which is highly important, but I think it's the wrong debate. The debate is about protecting land and the public trust that it was put into place when this land was protected.
Okay, we're going to go to Shane on the north side. Shane, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. So I'm Shane Williams. I'm from North Jacksonville. I actually reside at Shady Rest, and I, too, have fought side-by-side with Lisa Ryman, the river keeper, on many different issues. But I wanted to just call in and support Black Hammock Island. You know, it's encouraging to hear that people are realizing that land needs to be preserved.
Thank you, Shane. Thank you for your comments. So, Lisa Ryman, You and, of course, also Mark Middlebrook from the Timucuan Parks Foundation and a lot of other environmentalists are saying this is a false choice. There isn't a choice between these two lands. We can preserve them both. But what's not yet on paper, but what will be on paper in this swap is a choice between these two parcels of land. That would be the choice that will be up to Florida Governor Rick Scott and the Florida Cabinet. If it were to get to the point of an actual official proposal, they would have to approve that. Then, of course, the Department of Environmental Protection will have to approve it, and then the St. John's River Water Management District. So it has a lot to go through, and we are talking, just so that every one of our listeners know, we are talking about almost a proposed proposal at this point. It isn't official, but it does seem to kind of be in the most practical sense of the definition of the word, a choice. It seems to be a choice between those two. That's what people will be voting on.
Well, but the choice is here. Are we going to stand up and protect the integrity of these conservation land programs? The preservation project was meant to be protected and is committed to the public, that this public dollars, this public land, will be protected into perpetuity. Florida Forever funds that were used at the state level, designed to protect these lands, to make sure we're managing growth, protecting these environmentally sensitive areas, water quality, and provide access to the real Florida. So if we set this precedent to put highly valuable ecologically sensitive, high biodiversity land, you know, and just gut the heart out of this preserve for the sake of the other, that's a bad, scary precedent, and everyone in the state of Florida should be concerned.
Steve, I want to bring you back in before we get back to some more calls. And
I want to jump in. She didn't answer the question. You were very frank in saying that it is a choice. That's what the decision is. And in the last 20 minutes, Lisa has yet to mention the words Black Hammock Island.
That is not true. I have actually mentioned the value of Black Hammock Island. We would support that. In fact, we have fought for more than 6 years to make sure there's dedicated funding at the state for purchases just like this that's needed on Black Hammock Island. We've also worked with Senator Bradley to reserve funds.
You want both.
We want to protect the waters of the state of Florida and the conservation lands, to manage growth, to make sure these areas, these waters are protected for my children, your grandchildren, and all of future generations.
Well, then we don't disagree. The problem is there's a choice. And Mark Wood wrote a column today that I thought was just so far off base in saying that, you know, there's some toilets broken in Yellowstone Park. You'd hate to sell off Yellowstone Park to fix the toilets. That's not what the choice is. If there was 400 pristine, valuable acres on the west side of Yellowstone, and you could give up invaluable land on the east side and equal acreage, I would do that swap. And that's really what we're taking a look at. It'd be great if the choice was to buy both. That's not what the option is. That's not what's on the table. And simply going back to say we want to preserve land doesn't really address what choice is being presented.
So I want to just remind everyone, the number to call in is 549-2937. It doesn't seem like I need to remind people. We have some jammed phone lines. We're going to try to get to as many calls as we can and as many of your tweets and Facebook comments. I want to bring it back to Steve just for a second here to talk about the logistics and some of the politics up in Tallahassee that will be included in the approval, or will be indirectly tied to this type of approval. Governor Rick Scott will have to approve the swap with the rest of his cabinet, as would the Water Management District and DEP. Now, he's running for Bill Nelson's U.S. Senate seat right now and defending himself against claims he's anti-environment. How does this election year environment, pun slightly intended, affect the possibility that this swap will actually happen? I mean, we're still very far off.
It complicates certainly the decisions that have to be made. The decisions have to be made also, I should say, by 2/3 of the governor and cabinet meeting as a group. So
he could still vote against it, and his fellow members could
if everyone else goes for it.
Mm-hmm.
He could also vote to actually appropriate dollars from the Land and Water and Conservation Fund to purchase the land on Black Hammock Island. The only reason there's one choice on the table, as John keeps mentioning, is because that's what the developer is putting forward. We need our elected officials to stand up to the intent and the purpose of these conservation preserves.
Once again, I'll agree with that I would love to see more land preserved. Unfortunately, that's not the choice today. Right now, that land on Black Hammock Island is under contract, and the only way for the state to be able to purchase that at this point in time would be condemnation if they want to take the land away from the owner. And so that's why there is a choice of a swap. And if you argue that the Julington-Durman land is more valuable environmentally, despite the fact there's still about 1,000 acres that are going to stay there, than Black Hammock Island, well, then that's a reasonable position to take. I've long felt that Black Hammock Island, it was dangerous to have that developed. And all the issues about it have now been resolved through multiple lawsuits, and it's permitted and ready to go.
Mayor, what about the worry, the environmental worry of building close to these sensitive wetlands in Julington? The worry seems to be about runoff from fertilizers for lawns, or the almost non-permeable asphalt that will be put down that could see effluent from cars and stuff like that get into some of these sensitive areas. Right now, the way that that the environment seems to work is that you have this upland sand base. It takes in the water, it filters it through, and then it goes down to these wetlands. Is there an environmental worry here too? I mean, is that something that the developer would be looking at? Again, this has to be permitted and approved by DEP.
Well, and that's another concern I've got, is that it's a knee-jerk reaction without hearing what the plans are. And the property down there will be on a sewage treatment plant, unlike Black Hammock Island, which will be on septic tanks, which go right into the waterways. The runoff is going to be handled. The wetlands are preserved. You've still got a 1,000-acre buffer. And if you kayak on Julington Durban, even if this deal goes through, you're not even going to notice it. The beauty of Julington Durban is you feel like you're in a jungle. It's just gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's awfully gorgeous around Black Hammock Island as well, the kayak and the Timaquan. And there you've got vast spaces to be able to do that. And you just don't want, in the middle of that, a bunch of houses on septic tanks. And so I think the environmental issue, that the developer has a great plan to deal with that, if anybody wants to listen. And one of the dangers, and you know, I'm left on the environment. I mean, there's just no question that one of the dangers our movement has is jumping the gun and not hearing what the proposal is. Lisa did something, and you had your head chopped off, Lisa, that you agreed to not sue the city to stop port dredging in exchange for having the state tear down the Rodman Dam. And all of your colleagues hit the roof because they wanted to stop the dredging and they wanted the dam gone. And the question is, when you've got an option, you got to make a choice. You and the riverkeeper took a choice, which was for a limited period of time, you were going to hold off on the dredging. And this is the choice, Black Hammock Island or 400 acres down in the Julington Durban area. Well, I like Black Hammock Island.
Well, and I would even say what the proposal is on the table, and we have taken the time to make sure that we fully understand the threat that is in front of us that your client is proposing. But they're talking about, you know, putting paved parking and putting a dog park and putting amenities that aren't allowed in the agreement to protect these natural areas. Those type of facilities were not allowed or restricted to only natural-based activities in the agreement that you've proposed and worked on with the Water Management District to protect these uplands, to make sure that the uplands and the wetlands in the Julington area were protected into perpetuity.
All right. We have a lot of people that have been waiting very patiently on the phone. I want to get their comments on the air, and callers, try to be as concise as possible as we only have a few minutes left. Bobby on the north side. Bobby, let us know what your thoughts are.
Yes, I've listened very intently to this conversation, and having lived on Black Hammock Island, I can tell you, in all due respect, Mayor Delaney, and I respect you greatly, and I know both you and Lisa, that dog just won't hunt, because nobody's going to develop anything in Black Hammock Island. That time passed when the economic collapse came, and it may be under contract, but they're having trouble moving the existing structures. That's my number one concern. Number two, if you're going to try to swap land on Black Hammock for Julington, that property in Julington is worth three times what the property on Black Hammock is. If you're going to entertain it, give us three times the land.
Thank you.
Okay. Number two, the precedent that's going to be set by this is atrocious.
Thank you, Bobby. I'm going to go to Mayor Delaney to respond to that very quickly, and then I have a question for Steve, and then we'll get back to calls.
I couldn't hear him very well, to be honest, but I appreciate his comments. But the in my understanding, I mean, I don't think the developer would be buying that land if it was not developable. And that to me is what I've lusted after, is to try to get that land, the island, protected.
All right. And Steve, let's talk about, let's move on to more calls. I have missed my question for a second here. We'll go to Marcy, who's also on the north side. Marcy, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Marcy. I grew up right down the street from Black Hammock Island. My concern is that the area of Bartram that the city of Jacksonville agreed to preserve is suddenly no longer important when there's a developer involved. So who is to say that in 20 years they're not going to say the same thing and say, oh, now we no longer need Black Hammock Island? If Black Hammock Island was, lusted after, as Mayor Delaney has said, why wasn't it purchased originally? It's been available for many years. I think all the residents of Duval, especially us on the north side, are tired of developers dictating the future of Jacksonville.
We need
to have a plan, and we have a plan, and we need to stick with it.
Thank you, Marcy. Steve, really quickly, how common is this type of deal? I mean, is there precedence for this type of land swap, as large as it is, 400 some odd acres?
There are precedents. There is language in the state constitution and in state statutes spelling out what you got to do if you're a state agency considering surplusing conservation land. That being said, I am told that that to do this for 400 and some acres is quite rare. And actually, I was told by one man who's followed this stuff for a long time that he has never seen that sort of transaction.
Okay. And with this, Steve, the process here, my understanding is that you'd have to make the argument to the cabinet, to DEP, to the water management district, that the land that you are swapping out for is of similar environmental or conservation quality, essentially. You'd have to prove that it accomplishes the same goal.
It does. It does require that. One of the complications, I think, in this is the distance between the two pieces of land. I think there's a legitimate question to be asked about how you set a judgment that establishes the value of preserving property in Julington, Durbin, versus preserving property basically 25 miles away on a different portion of the waterway.
All right, we're going to go to another call, and then we have enough time for everybody to give some parting thoughts before we end the segment. So I've got one more call here. It's Robert on the north side. Robert, you're on the air, and please be as concise as you possibly can.
I'll try to. Moved down on Black Hammock in 1972. I know the full history of it. I was the first president of the association out here trying to preserve this and trying to get something out here in city services, and ran into complete dead end. I even tried to pull this out of the city and become our own city, incorporated, unincorporated, did not care. We couldn't get garbage service. We couldn't get police service. We couldn't get fire service, nothing. Joe Forche and Charlie Bennett helped me. We began to get things out here that helped us. But the Black Hammock Island is a barrier island, unique island. Talk to Charlie Bennett about making it a bird sanctuary. I didn't care. We just needed help.
Sure. Thank you, Robert. I'm going to have to...
It's worth preserving.
We're running out of time. I appreciate your comments. Mayor, can you give me some parting words for our listeners about this issue?
Well, it really goes back to two callers ago. We tried to buy it. The price was more than we had money for. So people have tried to preserve Black mm-hmm. Hammock Island. Steve, I think the person you took, or at least who you quoted, was the former head of Audubon about land swaps. Those go on with some frequency and at various sizes. And the question is it worth it? And I think you could argue, nope, keep Durbin. I kind of like Black Hammock Island. I just think it's a better choice when you don't have any money.
Lisa.
I just, you know, think that gutting one preserve for the sake of the other is a scary precedent, and it is something that will undermine water quality in Julington and Durban, the St. John's River. And we should put this energy around this conversation about trying to get dollars for Black Hammock Island, because, you know, focusing on looking at this area holistically is something that is critical to the overall health for our environment, for our economic prosperity, and for the future of Jacksonville.
Lisa Reinemann is the St. John's Riverkeeper. Steve Patterson is a reporter with the Florida Times Union. And John Delaney is a former mayor and working or will begin working in September for the Fiorentino Group, which has a developer, Tom Dotson, as a client. Thank you all for joining me for this lively conversation and listening to our listeners. We always appreciate it. And much more still ahead. We have Travel with Judy Wells, and later, how to make your air conditioning more efficient. But up next, or I'm sorry, that is up next. We'll be back in a moment.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com. The Florida Theater presents Ira Glass, creator and host of This American Life, live at the Florida Theater Saturday, November 10th, 8 p.m. Using audio clips, music, and video, Ira Glass delivers a unique talk sharing lessons from his life and career in storytelling. Ira Glass, live at Florida Theater. Tickets, floridatheater.com. Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, if you have an older HVAC system in your house, you know they can use a lot of electricity. Now, there has been a move to replace older HVACs and reduce their size and improve their energy and comfort, which is a function of performance. In today's Going Green segment, we're now joined by Kurt Kinder, owner of Greener Solutions Air.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Good morning. So tell us a little bit about, let's start from like the very beginning. What is an HVAC system? And in Florida, people probably know it by the thermostat. They go and they flick it on in the summer when they're burning up. But what exactly is an HVAC system? It does a lot more than just cool down your house.
Well, basically, the most important thing this time of year is that it does cool down your house and make you comfortable, but the other element of it is the humidity. And particularly now with all of this rain we're getting every afternoon and the massive dew and moisture that's all over the house and all over the trees every morning, we know the primary comfort issue is humidity. And that's what drives people to often turn the thermostat down just because they're fighting humidity. And so they get either hot and muggy or cold and clammy. And we kind of push toward an integrated approach. We want to look at the building itself, trying to keep the moisture out, to reduce the load on the air conditioning system, allow it to be smaller, allow it to be more efficient, and more importantly, allow it to create comfort that people seek without causing more problems and expensive mold damage and so forth.
So what, in particular, what are some of the the specifics to our state? You mentioned the humidity, and I assume that that's going to be very different from somebody having an HVAC system, and let's say somewhere in New England. What makes the maintenance different here in Florida?
Well, again, it gets to our climate. In New England, where it's very cold in the winter, there's going to be a lot of focus on making sure a house is really well insulated and that the system can heat efficiently and completely. I grew up in Boston. We would get below zero, and you need the system to produce heat. Summer, air conditioning, you can get away without it, or it's only a few weeks, so it's not a great priority. Out west, it's really, really hot, but it's dry, so humidity isn't a huge issue. Down here, it's not as hot as it might be out west, but we've got this constant battle to fight with the humidity and prevent mold. And of course, we have to worry about hurricanes that load up our houses with horizontal rain coming in and causing damage. And all of this eventually becomes a problem with the air conditioning system to wring the water back out and get people comfortable. There's a lot of focus on, okay, it's not working today, call somebody to get it fixed. But let's take a broader look at other issues. Is the ductwork working correctly? Is the system sized properly? A lot of systems are oversized. More is not better. We want to get the sizing down to where the system is efficient, quiet, and once again, we're pushing for humidity control to truly get the comfort people need safely without having to set the thermostat too low.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned about the size of the actual system, because recently I actually had to replace my air conditioner. It went in the middle of this kind of heat wave that we're having, of course, because that's how it always happens. Yes.
Friday afternoon.
Right. Exactly. 5 o'clock. I had to wait, you know, all the way through the weekend to get somebody out. It was a very small system that we had out there, and it was old. We live in a historic neighborhood in a historic home that has had some updates over the years, but let's just say probably not as many updates as it needs. And they had to replace the whole system. And I got back out there, and I have a system that's now looks like it's double the size of what it once was. So the older system was smaller, and yes, it was having trouble, obviously, heating even my half of the home. I live in a duplex. But I come home after they've replaced it, and it's just this massive, massive box, and it sounds like an airplane is taking off every time I turn it on.
Oh, boy. What should have been done was what's called a manual J-load calculation to figure out how much AC your house really needed. Hopefully they didn't just replace like for like or say, oh, well, the small system's having trouble and it was broken. It wasn't that it wasn't the right size. And hopefully they didn't come in with a big one. It sounds like they might have. Now, for this equipment to physically grow, that's not uncommon, because in order to get the efficiency to hit today's minimum, what they call SEER rating, requires larger heat transfer surfaces, a fancy term for simply bigger coils, bigger fans, and so forth. So systems are physically bigger today to achieve the energy conservation, but you got to distinguish physical size from capacity, and we use a unit called tonnage, and that goes back 100 years to refrigeration systems. That the tonnage means the heat equivalent, a cooling equivalent of generating a ton of ice in a day, which you can imagine is a lot of cooling. So we bandy about 3 tons, 4 tons, 5 ton systems, but we want to make sure that it's the right size for the house and not to just give in to temptation to go for that, you know, V8 engine, so to speak, in a Toyota Prius. So, and speaking to an older home, you got to be particularly careful, because it may be 100 years old, 75 years old, and you have to make allowances for lack of insulation, older windows, leakier building structures. That's how it was built, probably before air conditioning. So air conditioning was added on, and you have to be really careful with that, not causing water damage and other issues.
It was sometime in the 40s.
Yeah,
it
did not have air conditioning when it was born. It might have gotten some window units in the 50s or 60s, and maybe its first central system in the 70s or 80s. So all of that would have had to have been grafted on. And we really earn our keep in those historic districts. And of course, there's a restrictions on what you can do for appearances and so forth.
Right. And, you know, that is one thing that we struggle with in the home that we have right now, because the windows aren't necessarily sealed properly. Sure. They're kind of the very, very old style with the rope pulley system. Yes.
The sash weight.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it is difficult to cool down the house in the heat of summer. I mean, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, with the sun shining down, and we're also at the top floor,
of course.
So it's very difficult to cool down the place at all, much less to keep it at that kind of 75 to 77 range, sure. Which is sure. comfortable but won't break the bank.
Yeah. And that's a good place to be, 75 to 77. I really cringe when I hear of people dropping the thermostat to 68 at night. that can turn your walls into a mold factory. You can literally total a house by misusing the air conditioning system. I've gone out on diagnostics and found the black mold in the walls. And I can't say mold because I'm not a licensed mold guy, but it's black. And if it walks like a duck, it probably is. Right. And I said, well, how do I fix this? This home is totaled. It can't be fixed economically. It's been abused that badly. That's what we ran into there. Now, you mentioned the windows. Everybody looks to windows and doors as being the sources of leaks. But one of the really good diagnostic tests to run on a home is a blower door test. It's a calibrated, computerized fan. It mounts in a doorway and would depressurize the house, equivalent to maybe a 20 or 30 mile an hour wind. And then technicians and even the homeowner can go around and find the leaks, because you can air condition a house pretty easily with modern equipment. What you can't do is air condition and dehumidify an entire neighborhood. So if your house leaks like a sieve, you're cooling your neighbor's backyards, and that you'll never get it done, and you'll just pay through the roof. And JEA will love you, but you won't love the outcome. So a blower door test really goes a long way to figuring out what's wrong with a house. And our approach is to look at the house, its occupants, the system, and its ductwork, all as one integrated system, rather than just focusing on boxes that make cold air magically come out of the ceiling.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of my dad complaining when I left the door open. You're trying to air condition the whole neighborhood?
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about the energy conservation point here. JEA does have a program that for free, someone will come out to your home, they'll test it, they'll see whether you're being energy efficient, they'll tell you where there might be some problems. But of course, it's up to you to get those things fixed, especially if you're a homeowner, right? Because if you're a tenant, you can maybe get your landlord, if you have a good landlord, over there to fix things, to ensure that you're not only that your bill goes down, but you're just being more conscious of the environment. So tell me, what are some of the newest trends, or let's start with some of the easiest things a homeowner or anyone really can do to make sure they're conserving the most energy when it comes to their HVAC?
Okay. HVAC is the largest user in a typical home. It's anywhere from 30 to 50%, sometimes even more of the total energy bill. And one answer, a common answer in the industry, is to increase the efficiency of the system. Get a SEER 18, SEER 19, SEER 20, what have you. In our market, I'm an AC guy, and I love to sell those systems, but the bottom line is you're not going to get the money back. Bump it up to maybe a SEER 15. Take advantage of what we call a variable speed air handler so that you can get good humidity control. And what we often find, I'm always going back to humidity. I know I sound like a broken record, but if we can get the humidity down, we'll get the comfort up and the thermostat setting can rise. We did a system where I was convinced 4-ton would do it, and 75 degrees. We had done a big renovation on the house to save energy, spray foam insulation, so forth and so on. But they put their fist on the table and said 72 degrees. I said, okay, no problem. We'll do it. 5 tons, bigger system, bigger ductwork, bigger check, a lot of money. And I came back to the house about 3 weeks later and checked. We'd put in a 4-zone system, pretty sophisticated on a multi-story house. And I went around 75, 76, 77 degrees were the set points. I said, what happened to 72? You've got a huge AC system. It costs more money because you wanted 72. And they said, we got cold. I said, you didn't get cold. You got dry. We reduced the humidity 10 to 15%, and suddenly they were comfortable at 75, 76, 77. And more importantly, they were cold at 72. They didn't need as much air conditioning as they thought they did. So it's a great lesson. It's a great story.
Now, obviously, you as a business owner would want people to come to you for their installations. But the fact is, a lot of people, some that don't have the choice because they're tenants or whatever, they may already get a new install, and they may look at it and they may think, well, you know, this looks really energy efficient. It'll have a label or a tag on it that says that it uses this much energy. And there's been a little bit of a controversy with that lately, because the discovery of some enterprising researchers has been that the label they get stuck on there, much like the organic label on fruits and vegetables, doesn't always necessarily mean that that's exactly the kind of power efficiency that you're getting. So in the last minute that we have here, what's a recommendation for those people who may be thinking, I got a little hoodwinked here?
Well, that high SEER system is only going to achieve that. It's like highway mileage. You can buy a 50 mile per gallon car, but if you fill the trunk with concrete or underinflate the tires or otherwise misuse it, you know, braking, jackrabbit starts, you're not going to get what's been promised. Mm-hmm. So that promised efficiency is in a lab in Pennsylvania. It's not in a house in Jacksonville.
Well, thank you so much, Kurt, for being here, for talking about this with us, and for giving our listeners tips on how to be more efficient with their air conditioning systems. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to First Coast Connect.
Community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the Compassionate Guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com. The Florida Theater presents Ira Glass, creator and host of This American Life, live at the Florida Theater Saturday, November 10th, 8 p.m. Using audio clips, music, and video, Ira Glass delivers a unique talk sharing lessons from his life and career in storytelling. Ira Glass, live at Florida Theater. Tickets, floridatheater.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the tradition of black athletes taking a stand. Journalist Howard Bryant's new book, The Heritage, traces athletes' political and social advocacy back to Jackie Robinson, Bill Russell, Muhammad Ali, and others. He'll tell us why athlete activism disappeared, how it came back, and was complicated by the patriotism of the post-9/11 era. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The big changes to immigration policy continue. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is ordering judges to stop granting asylum for most victims of domestic abuse and gang violence. He says people are abusing the asylum system to the detriment of folks who need it. What's behind this latest crackdown, and what will it mean for women and children at the border? Next time on 1A. Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Who started the fire?
What's on fire?
A transformer blew, a PG&E transformer, and it lit up a whole window.
And there are houses on fire? What's on fire?
After deadly fires across Northern California, getting to the bottom of how they started and who's responsible. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Finally, this hour, it was the most famous tourist one of the most famous tourist destinations in the world for a very long time, but there's still a lot to see that many visitors miss. It was the birthplace of China's first dynasty, paper, the Silk Road, the Great Wall, and the Chinese alphabet. It's the Shaanxi province. Our travel blogger Judy Wells recently paid a visit and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about when you went, how you ended up going, and some of your first discoveries.
Well, I was one of 13 writers, travel writers, and photographers invited by the Shaanxi Tourism Board to come and see what else was there besides the wonderful terracotta warriors and their horses.
So that's where... what part of China is this province in?
Shaanxi bisects the country south to Sichuan province, north to Outer Mongolia, and it's like going from chin to lips on the human torso.
Oh, okay.
And its midsection is Xi'an, which is where the Terracotta Army is that was ordered by China's first emperor, as well as the other things happened.
And these are some of the most famous images in history books and just online. People always see those terracotta warriors, and it evokes that.
You see them everywhere, but what people don't realize is that while about 600 have been unearthed, there are about 7,000 in total.
Wow.
And adjoining it is the emperor's city tomb, which is a virtual city that has been, we know where it is, it's been visually excavated by machines, but it has not been formally excavated. So this will be a center of tourism for generations to come.
How close did you get to that? I mean, was there any indication from the tourism board when tourists or even other people, you know, citizens of China will be able to see some of this stuff?
Right now, there's not much to see of the emperor's area. Mm-hmm. You can go by there. You can look at the lump on the ground. They have a museum of a few visions and things, the sites that they've seen, what they've got, but there's so much there they cannot begin to do that until they have finished with the warriors.
Mm.
So it's going to take a long time. it's one of the priorities of the tourism. But in the meantime, the board is saying, look, there's a lot more to see than just the Warriors. And there was. It was tremendous. Nearby in the Lishan Hot Spring area to the Warriors is the Tang Dynasty's Winter Palace. And there's a production there, A Song of Endless Sorrow, which is a crazy name for it. But it's based on a poem by Tang Dynasty poet Bai Zhuyi. He was the Barbara Cartland of his day. And it is a must-see. Set among the Huangqing Palace, it romanticizes the true story of an emperor who was so obsessed with a courtesan that he ignored his duties, was attacked by the populace, and forced to have his consort killed. The result, it's a multimedia spectacular that uses lyrical music, not the whang, whang, whang nasal stuff that we think of as Chinese music. This is lyrical. It's wonderful. Dance, brilliant costumes, water, fire, Mount Li, and even the stars to create an unforgettable experience. I'd recommend an overnight stay in that area. There's plenty more things. But back in Xi'an, you can walk or bike around the city walls. Now, these are gigantic. They were begun in the Tang Dynasty and rebuilt of brick in the Ming. And they now stand 40 feet high, 40 to 46 feet wide at the top, 50 to 60 feet wide at the bottom, and they stretch for 8.5 miles. You can get a great workout there. And it's surrounded by a moat and a park, and it's a super way to oversee the city and to watch the brides and grooms who gather with their attendants to get their wedding pictures made.
In the last few moments that we have, I need to know about the food. What was the food like in that province?
Figure it fit, meant for an emperor. There is, since 1936, Defangchang has been known as the number one dumpling banquet home. Over 200 types of dumplings. Boiled, steamed, fried, sautéed, broiled, and or baked in a variety of shapes and endless variety of fillings are available. We were stuffed at 20, overstuffed at 20. But the dishes special to that area are pita bread soaked in lamb soup, marinated meat in a baked bun that's like China's hamburger, spicy fish, sweet and sour Yellow River carp, hand-grabbed lamb, and noodles. God, rice, wheat, buckwheat, cold, hot, in between, spicy, sweet, or savory.
No shortage.
And I'd had places to go and things to see. Other things to see on my blog, wellsworld.net, that I do for this. There are wonderful hotels. I mentioned those.
Well, Judy, thank you so much for coming and telling us about this. And again, your blog again, wellsworld.net, if you want to read more about that.
And I have an offer for a great wellness getaway in Naples, Florida.
Well, make sure to check that out. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. Next is 1A with Joshua Johnson. I'm Ryan Bank, and you're listening to First Coast Connect.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.